on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, the semi-palmated sandpiper migrates annually from the Arctic to Brazil. Moncton filmmaker Anas Nanis captures its journey on film.
The majority of the population of the semi-palmated sandpipers come here to the Bay of Fundy. Like, we're talking worldwide population. The hardest documentary I've ever produced, by far.
Kavanawa Kilele was a Mount Allison University student from Kenya. Friends and students have come together to establish Mount Allison's first endowment supporting black students.
She boosted the confidence of a lot of people, especially of young women and of young women of color. The thing that I think stands out to me the most is just compassion for other people, for life, for herself, in a way that was bold.
The Journey Church in Calgary has been offering a daytime shelter for homeless and vulnerable people. Over the past months, more than 200 people knocked on its doors.
I would say about 75% of homeless friends are from different Indigenous backgrounds, and they come from Manitoba to Saskatchewan to Alberta to BC. They're from all over Canada, and they are wonderful people, absolutely wonderful.
And in Quebec, the Cowansville Reuse Eco Center collected 26,000 kilos of reusable furniture and construction materials in just 4 months. This and more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
First, we land in Northwest Calgary, where the Journey Church has been hosting a daytime shelter service for homeless and vulnerable people. Journey Church has been offering warm food, clothing, and hot chocolate to over 200 people during the last 4 months. The winter has been turbulent in Alberta, and while there were influxes of people at the church during cold snaps, volunteers at the church say most people just come for shelter and to feel like they have a safe place. Journalist Ryan Hunt spoke with one of those volunteers, Rob Ellis, at the daytime shelter.
Just alongside the Tuscany LRT station, you'll find Journey Church. The church has recently opened their doors to those experiencing homelessness and other vulnerabilities to have a place to eat and rest, knowing they'll be safe. Rob Ellis, a volunteer for the daytime service at Journey Church, spoke about what the church is doing and what they're providing.
We're inviting a little more than 200 people a week to come in, and we provide them with clothing and hot food and cereal and hot chocolate. My specialty is hot chocolate with marshmallows on top of it. And it's fun because we are able to develop a relationship with a lot of them. We become friends, and they know that it's a safe place to come to. My father grew up in a Cree reserve in Saskatchewan, so I would say about 75% of homeless friends are from different Indigenous backgrounds, and they come from Manitoba to Saskatchewan to Alberta to BC. They're from all over Canada, and they are wonderful people. Absolutely wonderful.
Mother Nature has been throwing all sorts of weather at us this winter, and Ellis says that the weather affects their work just a little.
We thought it would fluctuate with the cold weather, and obviously we get a few more people come through the door when it is really desperately cold. However, we're finding that they want to come here for rest, and they want to come here for food. The weather is no longer the major issue. They want to come here just to feel like they have a safe place all day long, and that they can get some food and have some rest, and they won't lose any of their items that they have with them. So we kind of protect them as a family.
Ellis says he's very happy about what's been happening at the church and is delighted about all he has learned.
The knowledge that I've gained in the last 4 months has been incredible. The homeless people, they are very much family driven. They stay together, they know each other, they help each other, and they direct their paths each and every day. So, for example, if they can find a place that serves the best hot chocolate in Calgary, they tell everybody about it. They come here and they kind of enjoy each other's company. And so I've learned a lot from each and every individual in the last 4 months.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide. When Mount Allison, the graduate Kavana Wakilele died unexpectedly 2 years ago in her home country of Kenya. A group of friends and students came together to establish an endowment to honor her memory. It will be Mount Allison's first endowment that specifically supports Black students. Kavana was known for her compassion and intelligence. She co-founded the Sackville Refugee Response Coalition, which helped resettle several families in the Maritimes. About $10,000 has been raised towards the goal of $25,000 for the endowment so far. People involved in the initiative include Kavanaugh's friends, members of the Sackville Refugee Response Coalition, the International Center, and the Black Students Union. David Gordon Kosh met up with Ellen Yao and Kit Nicholson, two Mount Allison University graduates involved in raising funds for the Kavanaugh Memorial Endowment Fund.
She was a natural leader in a way that drew many people to her as a very magnetic individual. One of the things that I really appreciated about her memorial service when she passed away was that all of these people who had been scattered all across the globe since we graduated from Mount A got together and were speaking about how influential she had been in their own lives, even if they hadn't ever mentioned it before, specifically to her or to other people. But one of the things that was really nice was that she boosted the confidence of a lot of people, especially of young women and of young women of color, to take up space in a institution that was not particularly welcoming all the time, or in a place that they were new and afraid in a different country. And she told them, you know, how to say no, how to stand up for themselves, how to speak their minds. And you see these stories over and over again of her charisma, I guess, bleeding out into other people. And that you really get to know once you watch her videos. She has a SoundCloud, you know, you hear her voice. She was very much into self-reflection in terms of always seeking to grow herself. You know, in terms of change starts at home, you know, how can I make the world a better place if I'm not willing to change as well? So she was always attentive and listening. And, you know, if you gave her constructive criticism, she would fix it just like that and never do that thing again. The thing that I think stands out to me the most is just compassion for other people, for life, for herself in a way that was bold. Our main goal is to create a scholarship that lasts in perpetuity to support Black students at Mount Allison University. And so our goal is to raise at least $25,000 to start awarding funds to Black students from all over the world, whether they're from Canada or from the African continent or from the Caribbean, in order to help their studies at Mount Allison University. Something that Kavana specifically struggled with was funding her tuition at Mount Allison as an international student and as someone who grew up with not a lot of money. She ended up having to work all over town to help cover her tuition costs. And so that's something we want to help other students with as well, in terms of making their academic career easier so they can focus on their studies, on personal growth, instead of worrying too much about the financial aspect behind it. Another of the aspects that we have included in the bursary is a criteria of social justice activism. We want to pay her legacy forward. And so we're still ironing out the specifics, but we do want to put someone who is active in their community or wants to make a change in the world in whatever aspect they're most comfortable with or interested in, and encourage them to do that in terms of giving them the tools and the facilities to become a young activist, become a young change builder.
Speaking of tuition, it bears mentioning that following the latest tuition hikes, Mount Allison tuition is $20,000 for international students, which is about twice as much as for full-time domestic students. The debt load in the Maritimes is about $40,000, the highest in the country.
part of the response when students oppose like tuition hikes is that, well, we've expanded like financial assistance for students, but oftentimes international students struggle with accessing this type of assistance. And again, we want to also attend to factors such as race and class and gender and how they shape one's ability to access an education and to be able to like succeed in a post-secondary setting. I think like this would be an important like first step for the university, especially considering that it doesn't have any any type of scholarship designed specifically for Black students.
Are you in contact with Kavana's family?
Yes, they have expressed their support. Kavana and I, well, we were best friends for a very long time. And so I knew her family going way back. And I got her parents, well, her mother's consent for naming the scholarship the Kavana Endowment. And then her brother and her sister have shown support as well. Something I raised to her mom, Phoebe, when Kavana passed away, was that I wanted to do something for her. And, you know, we talked about it for a bit. We decided that this was probably the best idea to do it was in Sackville at Mount A, because her mom, she grew up in Maputo, Mozambique, but she was originally from Nairobi, Kenya. And so her roots on the African continent are a bit split. But in Sackville, it was a nice centered thing where she had a lot of recent friends, and there was institutional backing from the university to like find something like this. And so, no, they're definitely involved and definitely very supportive.
You just heard from Kit Nicholson along with Helen Yao, graduates from Mount Allison University who are part of an effort to establish a bursary in memory of Kavana Wa Kilele.
Thank you to David Gordon Kosh.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Students all over the country have been hit hard by inflation, and many Ontario postgraduate students are feeling the crunch. In Kingston, Ontario, a graduate student union is rallying to abolish tuition altogether. Astrid Hobill, president of the Public Service Alliance of Canada 901, or PSAC 901, which represents 2,000 teaching assistants, teaching fellows, research assistants, postdoctoral scholars at Queen's University, believes that postsecondary tuition should be abolished as a whole because it's a barrier that prevents people from accessing education. The PSAC 901 union is currently pressuring Queen's University principal Patrick Dean to stop lobbying for the tuition freeze to end and instead to call on the provincial government for better funding packages for graduate students, if not to abolish graduate student tuition as a whole. The union presented to Principal Dean what it calls its ramen reasons, presenting a list of what students are going through and need. Alexandra Fernandez spoke with Astrid Hobill, president of PSAC 901 in Kingston.
Across the university, the minimum funding packages have not been raised in an incredibly long time. Okay. And so these graduate students were explaining to their profs and to the head of the department and to the graduate assistant and coordinator that they needed to have a higher minimum funding package because, as we know, in the last few years, rents have gone up hugely in the city. Yeah. Cost of living for everything, including groceries and whatnot, has also increased hugely. So we're really calling on the principal to support us in going to the government of Ontario and asking for more money to be put into post-secondary education rather than what they're currently doing, which is lobbying to have the tuition freeze taken off. And that would mean right. That tuition would be raised for everyone. And we think that that's currently would be harming everybody on campus. Yeah. And we need to instead work together and work constructively to get more money into post-secondary educations. In the short term, we've launched our mental health and hardship bursary for those who are in acute need of financial support. And the rally has also really raised awareness of our recently launched food support program, in which we provide, again, our members who are in acute need of food support, gift cards to your local grocery stores so that they are able to go and purchase some of their own products, because 52% of users of the AMS food bank on campus are graduate students at the moment, which is horrific and shocking when we're basically already kind of like we're partway through into our careers by the time, especially by the time you're in your fourth, fifth year PhD, like we are doing the exact same research. We're teaching the same courses that adjuncts and professors are. So we need to be treated as professionals.
That was Alexandra Fernandez speaking with Astrid Hobel, president of PSAC 901 in Kingston.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Quebec's eastern townships now, where the municipality of Cowansville is piling up great statistics with its new eco-center. The regional eco-center's reuse space is on a mission to divert construction waste from the landfill one piece at a time. And with the financial help of the Quebec government, the eco-center was able to expand its services and collect a dazzling 26,000 kilograms of construction materials within 5 months of its launch from August to December 2022. The Eco Center has become a kind of giant construction material and furniture bazaar. Materials collected are giving out for free to the region's citizens. The reuse space welcomes bulky items such as doors, windows, furniture, sports equipment, and more. People can drop their items off at the reuse space, and they can take other things they may need from the space free of charge. Taylor McClure talks with Oriana Familiar, Environmental Management Service Coordinator and Sustainable Development Advisor for the Municipality of Pro-Missisquoi.
Since the launch, which was officially August 22nd of 2022, we've been able to accumulate 26,000 kilograms of material. We're still waiting for the January reports, and just, well, February is not done yet. But to give you an idea, if I can put it into images for the people that are listening, actually a door, I mean, whatever door we have at our house, for example, a bedroom door or a bathroom door, is 20 kilos, more or less. And so if we divide it by the 26,000 kilograms, it's about 1,300 doors that we've been able to recover and divert from waste.
From going in the garbage.
Exactly. Yeah. And like you say, and this is just the beginning. People are just starting to learn about this space. So imagine how far we can go if we continue these efforts.
Exactly. Now, you know, we're saying reuse space. So what is the reuse space exactly? You're talking about construction materials, but I know that people can bring other things there as well, right?
Exactly. So the typical bulky items, they will also go into this category. So yes, we're targeting construction stuff like doors, windows, wood, leftovers, but also it can be any type of furniture. It can be toys. It can be big toys, obviously. Also sports equipment, anything that is bulky, that is big. We try to put it in this space. Just this phase that we have right now, which is people bringing stuff. And also a very important aspect is people can also take stuff. And it's all for free. It's actually every citizen is already paying for it. So it's a free service. They can leave and take as much as they want, as often as they want. There's no limits.
And this is for all Bro-Missisquoi citizens,
exactly,
right? Not just Townsville.
Perfect. Exactly, the 21 municipalities. And it's a good question, because when you go through the screening at the entrance of the eco-center, they will obviously ask you where you're coming from, what you have, and if you have a piece of ID to prove that you're actually able to use this this service. So for now, it's open to all the citizens of Bro-Missisquoi. We're talking about more than 60,000 citizens that have access to it every single day. But we have other phases that we're thinking about. For example, all the nonprofit organizations or community services that could have access to this space. They deal with a certain clientele or families that need, for example, furniture or doors, or do a little bit of renovations, or they have children that have sports needs in terms of equipment. So we try to help also the community. So that would be another phase to all the nonprofit organizations, the community services. And who knows, maybe one day also, if we have the proper space and operations to run it, to offer it to all the companies, to all the industries, because they're the ones also who have tons and tons of tonnage.
Industrial waste.
And even if they don't work specifically in the construction sector, it could be industries that they could, for example, do renovations and all of a sudden change their furniture, and they could have access to this space as well.
Now, I know that you're not here on the ground, you know, overseeing the daily operations of the reuse space, but from people who do oversee the space and people that you work with or people that work here at the Eco Center, have they spoken to you about the impact that this has had here so far in terms of waste, but maybe in terms of also helping citizens?
Yes, actually, there is a petition right now, and this might be, this is why we're thinking about the nonprofit organizations. We do have a pilot project right now. It's very little, but it was running from September to December last year, where we gave access to a few nonprofit organizations and some volunteer organizations. For example, the famous CABS that we call in French, yeah. The Center for Volunteering Action. And so we had a pilot project between 5 and 10 organizations had access, and we're evaluating it to see if we're ready this year to actually expand it. And that comes from feedback, actually, from the citizens telling us, well, we need spaces like this. Not everybody has access to the same resources or the same finances to be able to buy furniture or to buy yes. sports equipment. We want people to know about this space. It's just the beginning, but it has so much potential. But also for people to know that Eco Center has so many services to offer. People always think about the traditional categories like my batteries or my light bulbs or my cans of paint that are empty. But people can come here also to drop off other items, like we said, for the reuse space, but also, for example, to take stuff from the reuse space, but also, for example, compost. And it's actually the result of all the efforts of all the citizens. It's actually quality. I don't know if you know this, but there's different types of quality for compost. There's A, B, and C. And it's actually quality A, which is the top quality that you can have for compost.
That was Taylor McClure speaking with Oriana Familiar, Coordinator and Sustainable Development Advisor for the Municipality of Bow Mississauga. The Sackville Volga Cinema recently hosted the world premiere of the documentary Peep, The Great Migration, produced by Moncton filmmaker and Mount Allison graduate Anas Nanis. The documentary tells the story of the semi-palmated the sandpiper and its annual journey from the Arctic to Brazil. The bird makes a week-long refueling stop in the Bay of Fundy. Nanis says the nature documentary was one of the hardest projects he's worked on. It involved close to 30 full days of waiting for the right moments to film at various locations. He also had to contend with the Bay of Fundy winds and the need to keep his distance from his subjects. While the sandpipers are in the Bay of Fundy, they are feeding and resting, packing on enough weight to help them make the 72-hour journey to Brazil. Here's Anas Nanis in conversation with Erica Buckler in Sagna.
My name is Anas Nanis. I am a filmmaker, and I made Peep, The Great Migration. So the documentary covers the journey of a juvenile sandpiper, and it's covering its migration from the Arctic, and then they make a big stop here in the Bay of Fundy to feed, and then they go on to a 72-hour flight to Brazil. So it's covering its journey, why the Bay of Fundy is very important, why this area is very important for this bird, why they have been coming here for as long as we can remember. Well, we're not actually physically following them to all the way to Brazil, but there will be some footage covering them when they arrive there. The main focus is their stay here in Fundy. Yeah. So how they use this space, how they feed, when they feed, what they do, what are some of the obstacles they face, whether that's human interference or birds of prey like the peregrine falcon, and there will be a lot of footage of peregrine falcon attacks and how they escape and stuff like that.
How did you come across this story? How did you find it and what grabbed you about it?
I've done a small video a long time ago for Mount Allison. I was a Mount Allison student as well. I did a video. There was a summer internship for two students. They were doing an internship at the center. The majority of the population of the semi-palmated sandpipers come here to the Bay of Fundy. Like, we're talking worldwide population. We did that piece, and then almost 4 or 5 years after, I was planning on doing a documentary, a nature documentary. The idea came in, and this is a bird that I can easily cover. I can drive from Moncton to, you know, to the Bay of Fundy. What grabbed me into the idea is how important this bird to this area and why people need to be educated about this bird and what they do in here in Bay of Fundy.
I'm guessing there's going to be some amazing shots, and I'm sure it was technically challenging, possibly, to film these birds.
It is the hardest project I've ever worked on, the hardest documentary I've ever produced, by far. Mainly, first of all, because they are birds, they are unpredictable. You can't tell them, can you just stay still for a little bit? I'm just going to grab a quick shot. That doesn't happen. So that was one part where I had to stay hours and hours just like kind of like hidden and waiting for the right moment to happen. We're talking about at least like 30 days, 6 hours, 8 hours a day, just me. Yeah, just me sitting and waiting for the right moment to happen. And then there was that part. The other part, like the technical side of it, I've never done something of this magnitude as far as a documentary, you know, a nature documentary. So the equipment that I used, most of it is new to me. So there was a lot of like long lenses, zoom lenses that I have to use for, you know, different reasons. First, you can't get close to them. And also, if I get close to them to get my nice shot, it defeats the whole purpose of the documentary. Because my like the whole purpose is that to educate people on not getting close to them, giving them the space they need when they want to rest. I didn't use drones at all when it comes when the birds are there. I guess even the more challenging to this is the story. It's easier to get a story out of a person than it is out of a bird, right? Like, because for somebody that's watching, you can only see too much bird footage before you're like, okay, we got it. Yeah, there's a lot of birds that come here, you know? So we had as a team to come creative with the way we can deliver this series. How can we keep the audience connected to the story, and how can we make a story out of this bird comes here, they eat, they rest, they sleep, they eat, they rest, they sleep. There isn't much else they do. So we kind of had to, you know, like to go dig deeper into the bird, what they eat, how they eat, why is this food important, why they go to the Arctic first place, why they come here, why they go to Brazil. So it goes into details about this bird. So that was another challenging part about it.
What's your next project?
Currently, I am working on another documentary. Not related to birds or nature, even though I'm hoping to kind of go for another nature documentary. But the documentary I'm working on is called Exile 2. So I did a series last year, Exiled, like the first season, about a Syrian refugee family that came in here to Canada. So, you know, it's just takes you through that journey of them adapting to a new culture, a new language, their kids, you know, going to school and all of that. And now season two is going to be about Ukrainian families. I'm doing it about two Ukrainian families that moved in here because of the war that started last year. And it's you know, it's going to go into details about their lives in Ukraine and what's brought them here, what they like it, what they like about Canada, what they don't like about Canada, and all the different details.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Alexandra Fernandez, Ryan Hunt, Taylor McClure, David Gordon-Kosh, and Erica Butler. National editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.